Hello and welcome to the Juan Juan podcast. If you're enjoying the show, consider signing up for the Patreon. There you get ad-free content, early access, exclusive episodes, and monthly supporter hangouts. You can find it at patreon.com/the Juan Juan podcast. If you don't like the subscription-based models, there are other ways of supporting the show that are linked in the description. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this episode.
They said it was forbidden. They said it was dangerous. They were right. Introducing the Paranoid American Homunculus Owner's Manual. Dive into the arcane, into the hidden corners of the occult. This isn't just a comic. It's a hidden tome of supernatural power. All original artwork illustrating the groundbreaking research of Juan Ayala, one of the only living homunculologists of our time. Learn how to summon your own homunculus, an enigma wrapped in the fabric of reality itself, their power at your fingertips, their existence, your secret. Explore the mysteries of the Aristotelian, the spiritual, the Paracelsian, the Crowleyan homunculus, ancient knowledge lost to time, now unearthed in this forbidden tale. This comic book holds truths not meant for the light of day, knowledge that was buried, feared, and shunned. Are you ready to uncover the hidden, the Paranoid American Homunculus Owner's Manual, not for the faint of heart? Available now from Paranoid American. Get your copy at tjojp.com or paranoidamerican.com today.
Welcome to the Juan on Juan podcast with your host, Juan Ayala.
Yeah, and like you said, when they're pondering on these images, the way that Jung was practicing active imagination was to let an image come to you. And he actually said to do this when you're in a bad mood or when you have like some sort of overwhelming emotion. I think a lot of times that would be like anger, you know, like you're really pissed off. And he said that's actually a really good time to do active imagination, just to sit down and be like, all right, what is, you know, what image comes in my head with this anger? You know, where does this lead me? Some sort of picture in your head. Obviously, the alchemists had these pictures in front of them. They didn't have to necessarily dream them up. But he would sit there and let something come to him. And then, like you said, he would enter into the image. The process of active imagination is not just to watch a movie in your head. It's to actually break the barrier and step into, you know, so you see the image, you let it sort of animate, and then you step into it as a subject.
Back to another episode of the Juan Juan podcast. Your host, as always, Juan. Make sure to follow the show, social media, at the Juan on Juan podcast. Pretty much any social media platform. Follow the YouTube, Instagram, all that stuff. If you're listening to this on the RSS feed, take 2 seconds. Leave a 5-star review. If you're listening to this on YouTube or wherever, thumbs up, comment. Share with your family and friends. And for those that want some more, patreon.com/the Juan on Juan podcast and all that good stuff. Today we have a scholar, a homunculologist himself. We're going to be talking about a new type of homunculus tonight. We're joined by Professor Longo from the Longo Bros. What's up, dude?
What's going on, man? How are you?
Doing all right. It's been a little bit since we got together, so I figured, Hey, let's do this again. You hit me up with a new species of homunculi that I was very excited that we're going to probably be talking about tonight. But what have you been up to, dude? What have you been researching? What have you been reading? What have you been, what rabbit holes have you been going down?
Well, I told you last time you had me on by myself that I started a publishing company called Galaclass Books. And I've mainly been researching for the first book that we're putting out. It's a collection. It's going to be called Monad. and it's a collection of Neoplatonist writings. So there's Plotinus and Porphyry and Proclus in there. And I've, you know, I can't put the book out without having read all of it and really, you know, diced it up and digested it. So I've mainly been having to do that as a little bit of a homework assignment, but it's been really fulfilling and rewarding. I'm excited to, the book should probably be out in the next like 6 weeks, something like that, 2 months. So yeah, that's mainly what I've been up to. I've been reading other stuff too, though. But
did you have these, did you translate these, or were these already translated and you're just printing them?
Yeah, so these are the top tier translations by Thomas Taylor. So they were done in the late 1700s. And he was a living Platonist. Like, he was not a scholar. He was not like a professor of ancient Greek or something. He was a Platonist himself. So he was a monist Platonist, like through and through. And he also is considered the greatest translator of ancient Greek to English ever. So his translations are underappreciated in the modern era and underprinted for sure. And if I showed you a side by side with like the modern translations, you would laugh. I mean, it's almost hilarious. This guy is the guy to be reading if you're reading Plato, Aristotle, and the Neoplatonists, because he translated all their complete works. So go check him out. And obviously check our book out, because it's all his translations.
Yeah, this guy, I came across another Thomas Taylor that did that book that I think I talked to you about it. There's another Thomas Taylor of the A Voyage to the War. Let me see here. A Voyage to the... Voyage to the World of Cartesius. There was also another Thomas Taylor that here. See,
you did a video on that, right?
Yeah, I did. We did a whole video on it. So in English by T. Taylor. But when I first saw that, I thought that it was right the Taylor, right?
Yeah.
And apparently, and it's not because.
Interesting.
Let's see here. Was he 17th century? Was
no more 18th century.
So there's this guy here.
Oh, interesting. Also translating.
You see here,
it's in the name.
I think there's something, dare I say, talismanic of this Thomas the TT name, right? This guy was also a priest, so there's something definitely going on with that name.
Yeah.
And I want to say it was this cat, or it might have been our other guy, Taylor Thomas. Oh, here, yeah, Taylor Thomas, my bad. Whoops.
That's all good. So same thing.
So again, there's definitely something about the TT. So it was this guy here, very interesting. And his father was known as a friend to Puritans and silence ministers.
Wow.
Interesting. So this was the guy that translated that work of Cartesius, which is a story essentially about René Descartes. You can check it out. I think it's the Occult Book Club number 10. Which, dude, I'd love to have you on that show with, like, an obscure book that you've come across.
Yeah, got plenty. I would love to do that.
We can read it, break it down. But this book here, the interesting part about this book is that it's essentially a story about how René Descartes had figured out how to project his consciousness outwards into outer space. And this is actually the first time ever that the term outer space is used in the sci-fi sense. And this was published in 1694, I think, was the English version. And the interesting part about it, because you talked about monadology, right, and the monads. Well, in my studies of, right, the various alchemical rabbit holes that I find myself going down, I actually found out that the father of modern day binary code, Gottfried Leibniz, who wrote Moanatology, he was actually going around and he was kind of sort of obsessed with stories of transmutation. Have you heard about that before?
I've heard about that, yeah. Well, and his contemporary, like Newton, was himself a like full-on occultist, hermeticist. So it seems to sort of be the norm at that point in time. And they're definitely hard to say if that was what was aiding them in their discoveries or if they were maybe just unearthing stuff that had been around in more like in secret and the Rosicrucians and things like that. It's very possible. I mean, especially with Leibniz.
Because that's something that has always interested me. There's these works. So this book here from 1694, whatever it was. Yeah, so printed for Thomas Benn in 1694. This is supposedly a story, right? It's a story from another guy with two first names. So you have Gabriel Daniel. So very biblical. And then... Yeah. Right, and Taylor Thomas is kind of sort of two first names there. Yeah. But this idea of Descartes, and I think that he was like onto something. Now, you can't really find anything relating him with like alchemy, but I don't know if you've ever heard, have you ever read The Secret Notebook of René Descartes? Have you read that?
No. So we carry it in the bookstore, and I know that I've seen you talk about it. And I always look at it, like I'll see it on the shelf and be like, well, I'm going to visit that one day because it's really, I know a lot though about him because I've watched your episode on Descartes. I don't forgot who you did it with, but.
With Thomas.
I watched that one and that was fascinating. I mean, the dreams he's having, visions, like, I mean, all that kind of stuff is incredible.
Are you talking about the one that I did with the Stoicism guy? I forget his name. Jeez. Oh,
I don't remember who you did it with, but
the name
something.
Escapes me. Yeah, I did a whole episode on Descartes. It was only a section of Descartes though, because Descartes' philosophy is so vast, and it's another one that's always like captivated me. And I feel like there's more to his story than what mainstream history has let on. And this book here, A Voyage Through the World of Cartesius, really filled in some gaps as to the story of Cartesius. And you got to read that book, the Secret Notebook of Descartes. It's such a mind-blowing read. It's like banger after banger after banger after banger. And then the fact that he was messing around with automaton too. I don't know if you ever heard that story, that he had like a robotic daughter, essentially.
Yeah, I've heard things like that. Yeah. Insane.
Because back then, they had this whole thing with automatons in churches, bro. They had, like, entire devils that are... And let me pull up this picture here of, the like, this devil that was... And I think Prague was known for that, too.
They were, like, mechanical birds and clocks and things. Well, when you had me on and we're talking about the Byzantine Empire, I remember telling you, because people don't know that the Byzantines had automata. More than a thousand years ago, which is insane. They had lions like next to the throne of the emperor that would roar. They had
how terrifying little, this thing is.
Golden birds and things. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, that thing is horrifying.
You're kind of cranking his dick here, bro. Like they put it right there where a schlong would be. You think that was done on purpose?
No, I'm kidding. 100% on purpose. No way you could put that anywhere.
Or you could put it on the back and they put it on the front right where his wiener would be. So this thing here, let me find what's the name of it? So Italian, so it's from the 16th century and it's from Wunderkammer of Ludovico Setala. So, automata were theologically and culturally familiar things with which one could be on easy terms. They were funny, sometimes bawdy, and they were everywhere. Mechanical devils were rife, poised in Socrates. How do you say that word? Socrates? Sacristies? Man, Now we're just getting warmed up, ladies and gentlemen, so we're going to get some words wrong. They made horrible faces, howled, and stuck out their tongues to instill fear in the hearts of sinners. The Satan machines rolled their eyes and flailed their arms and wings. Some even had movable horns and crowns. A muscular crank-operated devil with sharply pointed ears and wild eyes remains in residence of Castello Sforzesco in Milan. And this is an interesting family, too, this for the Sforza family, which Catherine of Sforza, she was also one of the first women alchemists. I'm going to be doing an episode on her soon. She has a really interesting history. And yeah, this whole automata of thing, and people really thought that this was, a lot of people thought that these things were actually possessed by demons.
Yeah, I would believe it if it was the 1500s.
It's look
crazy.
Let's look up.
We never talked about this too when we talked about Prague. Is the infant Jesus of Prague? It's like a famous famous statue. I don't think we talked about it.
No, we didn't. Is this? This looks like a Descartes. Hold up. Oh no. Ooh, this guy's deep. So, oh yeah, there's some stuff here. All right, so the infant Jesus.
Yeah.
Infant. Whoa, Jesus. Yeah.
That's a good Wikipedia. If anyone's bored, just go read that Wikipedia page. This creepy little statue. Look how small it is, too.
This with that thing, head. Bro.
Dude, the stories are wild. It's right. Full on, like, we actually have a portrait of it in the store. And it definitely has power, for sure. There's something to it. I don't know what the power is, but it has some sort of gravity to it that's... like portraits of it and things are very alluring.
What?
Yeah, it's odd. And that statue, it's an icon because this is Eastern Christianity. So they like pray to that and like offer devotions to it and stuff. It's very much like idolatrous, even though it's supposed to be Jesus. And the stories on the Wikipedia are wild. Like monks who hear it like talking to them in their head. And like telling them to do stuff. At one point, it got destroyed in the 1600s. I think what this is all top of the dome, but 1600 or 1700s.
Yeah, through the stories.
Yeah, so it gets destroyed. Sorry if you can hear my dog squeaking. It's a boy. It's probably annoying.
So we have here, because I remember you talking to me about that day that I was at the store and. I had looked it up briefly while we were there. So it's Niño Jesús de Praga, 16th century wax coated wooden statue of Child Jesus holding a Globus Cruciger. Of course. And this is crazy, bro, because I was watching a documentary on Prague the other day. Because I want to go, bro. I want to go to Prague. Prague is like one of those places that it is magical, right? And I didn't know that the origins of the crater, because you gave me that piece of moldavite, which Prague is rich in moldavite. The lure of that crater at Prague that hit and spread that moldavite around, supposedly that meteor or that asteroid, whatever you want to call it, was a stone that fell off the crown of Lucifer. And it fell down to Earth, and it crashed where Prague is, right?
Yeah.
So.
Wow, that's some Steinerian stuff, sounds like. Yeah. But yeah, it created the Prague Basin that Prague is in. Like, it's a big valley, and it has moldavite everywhere. It's like in the soil of Prague. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. But so the infant Jesus gets destroyed. And it's missing its arms and pieces. And it's one day there, I think it was like in a pile of rubble or something. And one of the monks, because this is after a war, one of the monks is just walking around. They're like trying to rebuild the church or whatever. And he hears a voice in his head, like calling out. And it's saying, give me back my arms. Like, put me back together. and put me, you know, like find me basically. It's so creepy when you think about it. Even though this is supposed to be like a Jesus statue. I mean, Kima, it sounds like. It
sounds demonic.
Yeah, it sounds like a little demon baby, like, give me my arms, you know, like a little Chucky thing. And basically, yeah, and then ever since, they did put it back together. And it's still, like, worshipped by people from all over the world that go and visit Prague. But there's so many other stories. That's, like, the first one. But there's so many other stories of, yeah, visions and hearing it talk, like, in your head and things. I mean, really, really trippy.
So we have... is this from, is there a book on it? Right, there's a book on it, right? The history. So one legend says that a monk in a desolated monastery somewhere between Cordoba and Seville had a vision of a little boy telling him to pray. The monk had spent several hours praying, and then he made a figure of the child. And this is so weird because they use it for rituals too. And the House of Habsburg began ruling the Kingdom of Bohemia in 1526. The kingdom developed close ties with Spain. The statue first appeared in 1556 when Maria Maximiliana Marinquez de Lara and Mendoza brought the image to Bohemia upon her marriage to Czech nobleman of this guy's name, Vistrilslav of Perstein, an old legend in the Lobkowski family reports that Maria's mother, Doña Isabella, had been given the statue by Teresa of Avila herself. Wow. Maria received the family heirloom as a wedding present. In 1587, she gave it to her daughter, Polyxena of Lobkowisks, whatever, as a wedding present. And then, here we go. Come on, give me the juice. So the oratory, which is an interesting thing with alchemists as well, is placed in oratory and the monastery of Our Lady of Victory, Prague, where special devotions to Jesus were offered before it twice a day. What a weird thing to do. That is so...
That's what I'm saying. It's so strange. Like, what is going on? And that's... And even the ties to Teresa of Avila, she's a super interesting character. So if it did come from her, that would be even crazier. Because she's a Christian mystic nun.
Really?
Yeah, she's really important. Yeah, and she claims to have like two straight years of visions of Jesus, like in the body, like all kinds of crazy like imagery and stuff. And there's books about her and stuff that are good. And it's another rabbit hole. But so, if it's tied to her, I mean, that's even crazier.
Because, you know, here's the thing with certain denominations, right? You have Catholicism, you have Christianity, you have all these different versions. And when I grew up, right, Christian, this was all demonic. You couldn't worship idols, all this other stuff. And you have certain denominations of certain sects of whatever that do worship these things. And what I'm seeing here is a pattern of, like, for example, this Teresa of Avila person who was a Christian mystic, which we know... Christian mysticism is tied to the Rosicrucian movement and all these different, right? All these different occult orders that stem from that same ideology, essentially. And what I see going on here is that perhaps these people, like the first in their order, if you will, they had knowledge and practices that perhaps weren't passed down. Because if you look at like nuns and monks and all these, they're like secret societies, essentially, right? And the knowledge, I guess, gets diluted within these organizations, and they're not going to pass down this sacred knowledge of maybe, perhaps, I don't know, imbuing this little statue with a spirit of some angel or something. Because what else are you going to, bro? What else are you going to do with it? It's like the genie in the bottle. The genie's inside this thing. He's trapped, and it's like, what was that? I just finished seeing something, or I was reading something where they were trying to convince... Oh, Beetlejuice, right? Beetlejuice tells you, like, hey, say my name three times, and I'll... Yeah. Da, da, da. It's like, you have to do what that thing says to bring it into this realm. And it's right. I saw this reel about it. It was like she would say Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and then because like at the end she wouldn't say like the third Beetlejuice, so he couldn't come into existence or whatever. But it just it makes me think of that and it being some sort of talisman. And I've never heard of this Teresa character.
Oh yeah, she's a big time. And Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, who's a Christian mystic, he also had things where he said certain portraits of the Madonna, so of Mary and Jesus, had healing powers, like just on their own as a painting. And so it's a similar sort of thing. And he was a Rosicrucian. It's very possible that sort of these Christian mystical practices were passed down in secret, and they're ecstatic, so they rely on mystical experience, ecstasy, nice. Things that maybe aren't for the masses or aren't easy to convey in language and put into a book. Jacob Boehm and all kinds of other people who have had these mystical experiences as Christians. And with Christian imagery and everything, and they kind of just get ignored by the mainstream. But it does exist, absolutely, without a doubt.
So, though there are no written historical accounts establishing that Teresa of Avila ever owned the famous infant Jesus of Prague statue, according to tradition, such a statue is said to have been in her possession. Teresa is reputed to have given it to a noble woman traveling to Prague. The age of the statue dates to approximately the time as Teresa. It has been thought that Teresa carried a portable Jesus or portable statue of the child Jesus wherever she went. The idea circulated in the earth. So you touched on something that's important to this sect of religion, for lack of a better term, where they are very heavily influenced by imagery, right? So they are, you ever heard of the Rothschild Canticles? You ever looked at that book before? Rothschild Canticles?
I don't think so.
So it's an illuminated manuscript, I believe is what it is. And right, it's at Yale, of course, right? Because Yale has all the cool stuff in there. And this has one of the weirdest depictions of, I call it Cthulhu tentacle Jesus, because check this out, bro. This is a depiction of the Trinity. Okay. They are depicting, let me find a good picture of it. They are depicting, so check this out. It's like almost like a wormhole, butthole looking thing with like some tentacles coming out of it. And then right here, check this out. So this is supposed to be rays of light, of course, but it looks just really weird. And what these plates were serving as, they were just that. They were devices for you to meditate upon, for you to be able to become one with the source. So to come together with the Trinity, right? To get closer with the Godhead. But check this out. It's like very, very bizarre imagery.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Right. Well, if you think about Jacob Boehm too, the Christian mystic, his books are filled with imagery. And they are like, a lot of people think that it's probably because these sort of experiences cannot be put into language. They're like the unspeakable.
The unconscious,
Yeah. And it's just outside of what we can describe. We don't have words for what you're seeing, And like a dream too, when you come back from the dream, it's very difficult to describe what it was. Mm-hmm. You sort of just forget. And so I think images are used a lot of the time to convey that. Terence McKenna thought that we were going to have an archaic revival through psychedelics, which would bring us back to a sort of ecstatic, mystical based religion based on psychedelics, which would sort of tear the fabric of literacy and language and like this sort of cage that we're in. I'm not saying it's negative, but that Western and Eastern culture now is tied into. It's all print-based literacy, linguistics, everything like that. And we have very little relationship with like the shamanic, the mystical experience, you know. And he thought that psychedelics were going to bring us back to that. And through doing that, that they were going to sort of melt language and we were going to come up with some sort of new form of language using images, which is, by the way, images are so much more effective than language. They're intuitive and you can show something and just immediately know what it is instead of having to read a whole, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's yeah, maybe it's through symbol or language or something like that, but he foresaw it changing.
I want to point out too that this book is red, by the way, the Rothschilds canticle with the Rothschilds, of course, right? They're
yeah,
one of the most powerful families in the world. And they have some of the craziest books, bro. And
well, you have the red book by Jung, and
exactly.
then you have the Book of the Laws, which is also red and gold by Crowley.
Really?
Oh yeah, they look exactly the same, almost same coloring. If you look it up.
Like a first edition? Okay.
No, that one right there, like the normal, the one almost everyone has is that one.
Wow.
Yeah, and then you look up the red book and it's like the same thing.
Do you think maybe this was Crowley's red book? Because I mean they were contemporaries, weren't they?
They were contemporaries. I go deep on both of them. I'm actually reading the red book right now.
Ooh, you poor soul.
I don't know if you've read it, but it's incredible.
I've read it, dude. I don't know about you, man, but like I've been reading some heavy stuff. I started a new series called the Completion of the Folconelli Affair, and every different episode is a different aspect of Folconelli. Yeah. And I've been reading just like the heaviest stuff, because I last night I was actually reading Merry Friends, and the idea of the Gerard Dorn and how they were able to come up with the idea of synchronicities and the parallels between alchemy and the Jungian aspect. But these are things that when you read it, right, for example, like the Folconelli stuff, when I'm reading that, I can't sit and read 100 pages. I got to take it like 10 pages at a time, sit down, digest what I'm reading. And the same thing with like the Jungian stuff. I got to pick it up, read 5 pages, if I can even get to that, because it's just so mind-blowing and so mind-numbing of the concepts that you're learning. It's like, wait, it's too much to take in at one time, you know? And I think that's one of the things that's really it kind of turned me off at first with Jung, but I feel like there are certain things that you might not resonate with because you're not at that level yet, right? There's levels to this. And there's certain things that you can't just jump in. It's like, oh, you want to learn about the occult, you want to learn about, and it's like, no, you have to work your way up little by little to get to that. So, you know, you start off with like the secret teachings of all ages, and then you can jump into the infant Jesus of Prague, perhaps being some sort of vessel for a demonic entity, right? Yeah. Sort of things like that. But you got to start off slow and work your way up into that realm of things.
Sure. Yeah. I think I've worked my way up there. And the red book, to me, I'm almost done with it. I've been reading it for a few weeks, and to me, it's a modern holy book, without a doubt. I don't see how it's not. I mean, in terms of the last 100 years, it's about all we have. It is absolutely like astonishing. I've been blown away. It has adventure to it through the stories it's telling, like the dreams, visions. It has all the mysticism and metaphysics and even religion, philosophy that you could ask for. I mean, it's really, really rewarding. I definitely recommend it. I can't believe how mystical he was. So I knew the Red Book was, I knew what it was. I had had a copy for years. I just hadn't read it. I read a bunch of his other stuff. But I'd always had heard, and I just hadn't done the research. I had heard that he wrote it later in his life. And he got a little bit trippier, a little bit more mystical towards the end. And I was like, and I knew that it was active imagination and like automatic writing, things like that. And I was like, okay, like, you know, little mystical experiments. Like, I don't know. It doesn't sound maybe like that interesting. And I dove in a few weeks ago and I was shocked. I mean, just in the preface, in the intro, they tell you like he was working on this in 1914, which is way early in his career. I mean, and then, you know, he died in the 50s. So that's telling you he had been working on this on the side his entire life. And I didn't know that at all going into it. And so that was already like a shock. I was like, what? Like, he was doing this the whole time? And then, you know, getting into it was just like blew my socks off. I mean, I had no idea he was a full on mystic. I mean, like as crazy as we've had in the last 100 years, Jung is at the top. He's known as a psychologist, but all of his psychology, which is what, you know, find out through the book, all of his psychology and his theories were informed through mystical vision, dream, you know, encounters with his own soul, with the devil, and, you know, all these crazy stories. I mean, definitely encourage people to go. It is tough. Like you're saying, it's not something I would start out with. But if you've done, you know, if you educated yourself, I would go check it out because it's pretty insane.
That's one of the things I love about Jung, where it is an academic approach to occultism, which is essentially what he was doing. And he was doing what, do you think that, right? Because towards the end of his life, and I'm going to bring some stuff up here, he had even, right, the stone, right, the cube with the little homunculus on it, which I'll bring up here because it's linking into like some other stuff that I've been, because he was obsessed with alchemy, right? He was obsessed with alchemy. Yes. A lot of the ideas that he got from alchemy. And he believed that alchemists were causing, they were like the first self-help people, essentially, of history. Yeah. And I stumbled across where I was doing some Theatrum Chemicum studies, and I stumbled across this Gerard Dorn guy because I was doing a trans. Yeah. There's something about like the Genesis commentaries that really interests me. And yeah. A lot of them haven't been translated, so I translated one from the Theatrum Chemicum, and I did a whole episode on it. This Gerard Dorn guy, which is like the super obscure alchemist who was responsible for translating a lot of Paracelsus' work into what we know today, right, from German to Latin, and apparently he was one of the most cited alchemists by Jung. It was the most cited alchemist by Jung. And when he was traveling in India or whatever it was, he carried the Theatrum Chemicum around with him, and he studied specifically Gerard Dorn's work. And from Gerard Dorn's alchemical work was what helped him come up with this active imagination or synchronicities or whatever it was. A lot of the ideas, bro, stem from Dorn's work. So as I'm reading that, go ahead.
I was going to say, in the Red Book, just a quick interruption. In the Red Book, he says that Jung believes that alchemists were practicing active imagination in their laboratories. So the processes of almost, you know, coming up with a hypothesis or a way of getting something done chemically were exercising certain functions of the imagination and drawing you out into like this sort of deep imaginatory state, you know, almost like a daydream on steroids. And in that state, things become mythical, whether you like it or not, and, you know, become archetypal. And that's the reason that they started taking forms of, you know, green lions and suns and all, you know, all those sorts of things, at least according to Jung, but you can go on.
So from this guy's work, he developed a lot of these things, and how you're saying, like, and that's the thing about alchemy that really gets me, because it's like there's so much. I believe that was an aspect of it, this idea of active imagination, quite literally going into your head and having an entire laboratory or oratory, which is essentially what they wanted, because a lot of these plates that you see of these alchemists, they were mandalas. They were for meditation, so the alchemist could go into that painting or that plate, whatever it was, and do his working while inside of there. But then we can't deny the fact of the practical side of alchemy. So we got the symbolic stuff, cool, but from alchemy, like the actual either wet path or dry path, whichever one you want to talk about, like Leibniz, he was hanging out with the guy that created porcelain, bro. He started the guy that he was with started what we know today as like commercial porcelain development, like the production of porcelain. And that came from a guy who allegedly had transmuted lead into gold with a powder projection. And the government was like, yo, get that guy like right now. We need him right. So because this guy did a transmutation in front of some other people, the people ratted him out. And then the king was looking for him like, yo, what are you doing? You got to come with us, because that's the whole thing with alchemists. Like, you can't usurp the crown or whatever it is. You have to work for us if you're going to have these secrets. So a guy who performed a transmutation from his alchemical workings of practical alchemy helped develop the commercial trade of porcelain that we know today. So it's like, we can't ignore like the actual aspect of the,
Without a doubt, it is the earliest form of chemistry. Their ideas about the scientific method, you know, about experimentation, you know, those things all come out of alchemy. Modern medicine through Paracelsus, how he viewed plants and materials and like the essences that they carried, led to modern medicine, pharmacology. There's no taking that away. And you know, it's like anything else. There's a literal and a symbolic. Like the Bible can be, you know, what you want it to be symbolically. You know, the rabbit holes are endless there, or it can be literal. You know, I mean, it could be a historical document.
Mm-hmm.
And so they both coexist. It's neither one nor the other. It's like a Venn diagram of both or something. And yeah, alchemy is, and like you said, when they're pondering on these images, the way that Jung was practicing active imagination was to let an image come to you. And he actually said to do this when you're in a bad mood, or when you have like some sort of overwhelming emotion. I think a lot of times that would be like anger. You know, like you're really pissed off. And he said that's actually a really good time just to do active imagination, just to sit down and be like, all right, what image comes in my head with this anger? You know, where does this lead me? Some sort of picture in your head. Obviously, the alchemists had these pictures in front of them. They didn't have to necessarily dream them up. But he would sit there and let something come to him. And then, like you said, he would enter into the image. So the process of active imagination is not just to watch a movie in your head. It's to actually break the barrier and step into, so you see the image, you let it sort of animate, and then you step into it as a subject and you experience that world. And the alchemists were doing that. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, if you look at what they were doing, in what Jung was doing with the Red Book, they're the same thing. I mean, of course, that's where he's got it too. You know, I mean, it's no coincidence.
Yeah, no, it's, and that's why I feel like they were doing the work on multiple dimensions. So this active imagination place, this other realm, and this property he had, right, Bollingen Tower, or Bollingen, however you want to say it, he lived here, right? Every wizard has a tower, no? Right? You got Bach Tower, Bollingen Tower. So
that's the publisher too that publishes most of Jung and all the Jungians. It's Bollingen.
Interesting.
And owned by Princeton University, another Ivy League.
The thing that's interesting about this property is this cubical stone. Now, what's interesting about this stone is that it's got a homunculus on it. And Telesphorus was a... So let me read the inscription. So, one side contains a quote taken from the Rosarium Philosophorum. Here stands the mean, uncommonly stone. 'Tis very cheap in price. The more it is despised by fools, the more loved by the wise. What a weird... And this text, too, is another weird alchemical text. But the more it is despised by fools, the more loved by the wise. So again, this idea of, right, you get made fun of, like, oh, alchemy, there was no such thing as a stone. It's like, well, how do you know, right? Like, oh, yeah, you're an idiot for thinking that. It's like, well, the more it's despised by these fools, dude, that know no better, then, right, the more loved by the wise, which the wise would be the people in the know. And, right, so the second side of the cube depicts a Telesphorus figure, which a homunculus bearing a lantern wearing a hooded cape, surrounded by the Greek inscription. The inscription says, time is a child, playing like a child, playing a board game, the kingdom of the child. This is Telesphorus, who roams through the dark regions of this cosmos, and glows like a star out of the depths. He points the way to the gates of the sun and to the land of dreams.
Damn.
That goes hard in the paint. And the second side also contains a four-part mandala of alchemical significance. The top quarter of the mandala is dedicated to Saturn, the bottom quarter to Mars, the left to Sol or Jupiter, and the right to Luna. So you have, again, this alchemical alignment, right? The typical alchemical concoction, right? You always have Saturn, you always have Mercury as well. You have all these right in these plates. And one of the inscriptions reads, I am an orphan, alone, nevertheless, I am found everywhere. I am one, but opposed to myself. I am youth and old man at one and the same time. I have no neither father nor mother, because I had to be fetched out of the deep like a fish, or fell like a white stone from heaven. In woods and mountains I roam, but I am hidden in the innermost soul of man. I am mortal for everyone, yet I am not touched by the cycle of the of aeons. Wow. Okay, so we got some heavy stuff here. I am an orphan. So again, talking about a homunculus, 100%. I am known neither father nor mother, because I had to be fetched out of the deep like a fish, or fell like a white stone from heaven. And this is an interesting connection here, because I just got done covering Polaris, which is this, or Polaria, the white stone. So I forget the name, but I'll look it up here in a second. Or you have the white stone, which is also one of the magnum opi or opus. Opi, yeah. Is opi plural, right? Opi?
Yeah, I think so.
The white stone creates silver, and then the red stone creates the gold. And this is very Paracelsian here. I'm hidden in the innermost soul of man. But one of the interesting parts of Dorne was Dorne said, turn yourself into the philosophical stone. So he took all of these like philosophical aspects, and or these practical aspects of like the work, like the, you know, the great work, and turn into a more of a philosophical thing, right? So it was more in a spiritual inner working type of thing. And what's interesting about this Telesphorus guy is that, right, he's a minor child god of healing, and he was a possible son of Asclepius, right? Which is, this is the guy that gets turned into the golden ass, no?
I believe so, yeah. I think Asclepius has the medical symbol, I think.
Or I might be thinking of another guy. There's a guy that got turned into the golden ass. Who's the guy?
Yeah, Asclepius has the, what do they call that thing? Oh my god, I'm so stupid. It starts with a C.
I know. Apuleius. This guy here. Okay, I got him wrong. But yeah, not Asclepius, this Apuleius guy. Anyways,
okay.
Backtracking a little bit. So we have this, he was the son of him, and then right, frequently accompanied with Hygieia, which is, I guess, right, known for hygiene. That's where we get the word hygiene from, which is an interesting connection. And he symbolized recovery from illness, as his name means the accomplisher or bringer of completion in Greek. Representations of him are found mainly in Anatolia and along the Danube. Now, what's interesting about this little guy is that, have you ever heard of the, let me find it here, the Gate of Alchemy? Have you heard about that before? Let me find the name. Hold on. The this is important because I gotta get this right, because I came across this the other day. Forgot the name of it. What's it called? The Porta Alchemica. So it's, yeah, here we go. So the alchemical door, or the alchemy gate, or magic portal. Now, this is in Rome. And an interesting part about this, so this this story goes deep, right? It's obviously has some inscriptions on it that are allegedly, right, to achieve the magnum opus. There was a dude who had supposedly achieved the magnum opus and had left like some inscription. So they took those inscriptions and they put them on this gate. But whatever, that's not what interested me at first. When I first saw this, what stood out to me were these little dudes on the side, or homunculus, if you will, right?
Sure.
And these little dudes on the side here are representative of what's that? Of the Egyptian god, it's Bes. So right here, so-called Bes, which again, very interesting, because it's the protector of household, mothers, children, and childbirth. Similarly to our boy over here, right? Minor god, child of healing, right? And there was also something else about childbirth as well. Let me see here. Temple, tell us. So there's actually temples dedicated to this guy, bro. This little, he had a cult, right?
Yeah, I mean, isn't the infant Jesus of Prague a homunculus? it also has temples. You know, it also has a cult, basically. I mean, it's amazing.
I didn't say that. You said that, but sure. And so we have this weird little homunc god, right? That is supposedly
like a Trolls movie.
Yeah, and it's. This little best thing, right, is guarding this alchemical gate at this villa, right? And this is linked, bro. I went down this rabbit hole the other day. This has Kircher wrapped up in there, bro. The guy that supposedly did the transmutation was a pupil of Kircher. We know Kircher was writing about like the hollow earth and like, right, the subterranean realms and all this stuff. So there's like this whole thing, and there's an alchemical door on the side of a freaking rock. It's like, what are you supposed to, can you go into here? Like, or is there something about, right, the stone, similar to our boy here, tell us Forus, is like, is what's he guarding? Because right, he had some significance too. Yeah. Young,
right? Clearly. Yeah, because that was at his house, right?
Yeah, this was at that Bollingen tower.
Yeah, that he, well, and Jung also wore his golden ring.
Got Abraxas, huh?
Abraxas, yeah. Which was, to him, that was the Christian god and Satan unified into one being, which is really, and he goes over that in the Red Book and stuff, and it's really trippy. And so that's very monist, you know, to not have the duality, to have them unified into one, like, primal cause. And I don't know if you've read about Philemon, who's in the Red Book also. You ever looked into that?
He's like an entity. Mm-hmm. Fill me in. I've heard that name before. I'm pretty sure I've heard of him.
Philemon. Philemon, what is like Jung's guru?
Anima or something like that. What do you call
it? Teacher? No. He's more than that. He's almost like a guru, like a saint or something that he fought. He's like a magical. He's a magician, almost like a hermit type figure. But he takes form, so he'll take like the form of like some crazy creature or something, and he leads Jung through his visions and dreams. And Jung like would write like odes to Philemon and stuff, and like it's really trippy stuff. I mean,
who was the one with the inner demon? Was that Socrates?
Oh, with the daemon, yeah.
Socrates, right?
Yeah, all the Platonists and most of the Greeks will say they have because they thought that your daemon was the thing, like a creature almost, or an entity that ties you to matter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's your soul and there's matter, like your body, and there's something in between those two, and that's your daemon, basically, in Platonism.
And really quick, bro, I don't know if you... Do you know what the symbol to cinnabar looks like, bro?
To cinnabar, like in alchemy?
Yeah.
No, honestly. Let me look it up. Oh, you're going to look it up. Oh, damn. That's crazy.
That's weird, right?
Yeah.
Cinnabar, bro, is like right the like at the core of alchemy, and then here it is like, what?
Yeah.
So... It kind of looks like, I don't know, a 33.
Yeah.
That's wild. So, again, I don't know. Right? You have all these secret societies that use the 33. You had Christ that died at 33. You have 33 vertebrae. You have all these.
The God is, the word God appears 33 times in Genesis, too.
There you go. You have the Globus Cruciger, which back again to
By the way, in the Jewish Torah, it appears 32 times.
Interesting.
And so when Francis Bacon and the boys were doing the King James Bible, they added another one. They threw in another little extra God and made it 33 on purpose. So it proves that it's on purpose. I mean, I think we all know it's on purpose anyway. But for anyone who's like, oh, that's just, you know, like unconscious, or that just, you know, synchronicity, like, no. The Torah has 32. The Christian Old Testament, done up by Bacon, who was like straight up, you know, probably the founder of Freemasonry.
Do you believe that?
Could be. I mean, Mahal thought that. So,
do you believe that theory though, bro? That King James was surrounded by, right, like the whole Baconian theory.
Yeah. Well, yes, we can get into that. So Bacon did write, not write, but, you know, translated directly from Aramaic and Hebrew and so on into English and standardized the English language with the King James Bible for fact. We know Bacon was put in charge of that project. So he oversaw, you know, a committee of translators, like the best of the best that he had brought in, and he was given the task. Hey, you got to put this together. That we know, that's like historical fact. We know that for sure. There's other stuff like him founding Freemasonry, him, you know, being Shakespeare, things like that, which are speculative, possible. But we do know that he definitely put together the Bible. But yeah, him being Shakespeare, I think that's very possible. I mean, there's so much trippy stuff with Shakespeare. I don't know if you, I know you've read Secret Teachings, but it's pretty crazy.
It's wild. But, it's like, yeah, too much. That's another one of those theories where you got to read it like a piece at a time, because it's so much information just being thrown at you at one time that you're just
I could run down a few things just real quick on that about how sketchy Shakespeare is as a historical figure. As being like the guy who wrote all the plays, you know, he was the owner of the Globe Theater and that, oh, yeah, that guy. I mean, for example, the the town, Stratford, in England, where Shakespeare is from, they didn't have any schools that are like notable, like high level of education schools where he could have been educated the way you would have had needed to been to be Shakespeare. And there are some of these where I'm like, okay, like genius could account for this, you know, mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, Jimi Hendrix didn't go to art school.
He was a prodigy. Yeah.
It doesn't mean he wasn't Jimi Hendrix, but we can get to that. It's not just his education. This one's trippy. There's only 6 examples of Shakespeare's handwriting at all. 3 of those are in his will, and all 6 are his signature. So there's nothing outside that. That's in his personal handwriting by Shakespeare. That's crazy. There's no mention or evidence of a library, personal library owned by Shakespeare. So in his will, we have his will. In his will, there's no like, I bequeath to you my tomes of books, you know, that I've been studying. I mean, that's amazing. There's no personal library. It's rumored that his daughter was illiterate. That's another one, which is like, how could your dad be Shakespeare? And even though you're a woman, I understand you're a woman and, you know, hundreds of years ago, but still, like, dad's Shakespeare and didn't want you to read his books or something. He never starred in one of his own plays, which at the time was like crazy. At the time back then, if you were writing the play, you were the star of the play, basically. You would give yourself the part. But you know, you could say that one, okay, maybe he wasn't a good actor or something, because he played the ghost in Hamlet, which is funny, because Hamlet's supposed to be his dead son.
Maybe he was a little retarded, right? Maybe he was,
right? Could have been. Yeah. But I could just run through a few more, because I read Secret Teachings recently, so I got them. Yeah. I got them fresh.
Go ahead.
A bunch of his friends, like there's a guy named Ben Jonson, who's like a contemporary author with Shakespeare and was friends with William Shakespeare. And he says on record that he knew very little Latin, very little Greek, no Spanish or Danish or anything like that. But in the works, he's making puns on these other languages. He's showing like a familiarity with foreign languages and foreign places, as if he, you know, he's been to Denmark, he's been to Spain, you know, and this is some random dude. So, you know, when you're talking about it being Bacon, who Bacon is like well-traveled for sure, extremely well-educated. He's in like the royal courts. I mean, who's more likely? There's a few more, like Shakespeare's heirs in his will did not benefit financially from his works or take part in first publications of his works, which are called the folios. So they didn't even, in his will and afterwards, they weren't getting royalties and, you know, things like that from his work, which is like, why would they not be getting that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a few more, but...
So was he a real person or not? What's your opinion?
Probably a real person.
And what would they benefit from occulting and like, right, occulting it actually being Bacon? What's that other guy that they also talk about perhaps being Shakespeare too? Jeez, he was like an Earl of something or other. What's his name? Anyways, one of these other guys. I forgot his name. Anyways, there's like this dude on YouTube, I forget his name too, that goes hard in the paint on like this whole Baconian, the triple towel and all that stuff. And like when they take his covers and they do like this whole geometric line and taking the line and it points down to the E.
yeah. For anyone interested, read the Secret Teachings thing and go check out some stuff on you. It's endless rabbit hole. I mean, there's ciphers included.
Yes.
What else is there? I mean, there's stuff about puns on bacon and hogs and ham, all kinds of crazy stuff that point to Shakespeare being some sort of mythological character almost, you know, someone who was historical, who just, you know, they pinned Bacon's writings on. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know what you really gain from doing that. I'm trying to think. And,
yeah, because, yeah. You know, I think that, so I think Bacon was Bacon. I think Shakespeare was Shakespeare. And I think that, and it's difficult to pinpoint because you're talking about a guy who could, you could say, and you could argue single-handedly transform the English language as we know today. Okay.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And
prior to the two of them, so the King James Bible and the works of Shakespeare, the English language was not standardized. So there were little dialects of where you were from, and they all had little, it was very fractured. And those two works in the 1500s served to standardize a common language through the Bible and Shakespeare that we could all build on.
I like, have you ever heard of the Shakespeare and D connection? Have you ever heard of that connection there?
I've heard, you know, again, these are that's a possibility too, that there's all kinds of
the Garland brothers.
Yeah, there could be several. Yeah, they could all be working together for all we know, you know, at the same, all of these guys, you know, Bacon and Dee and who you name it.
They were all spies, right? That was like really popular back then, to be a freaking spy.
Right.
And that connection to me makes the most sense because there are those missing years of William Shakespeare's life. So it's like, where do you go for X amount of years? And it's like, Vincent Bridges did work on this where he traced back like, oh, look, there's records here of these Garland brothers traveling around with John Dee and Edward Kelly, you know, doing seances. And that's how he was able to learn about the occult and all these different aspects. And it's like, damn, that makes a lot of sense to me. But I do believe that Shakespeare was Shakespeare.
Yeah. I think Shakespeare is Bacon, but we'll call it a truth.
Because it's like, if let's say Bacon was Shakespeare, then who wrote Bacon? You know what I'm saying? Like, this guy was that prolific, bro, that he wrote all of Bacon plus... That'd be crazy, bro.
Yeah. It's... And put together the King James Bible.
And put... That's a lot of writing, you know what I'm saying?
And I mean, according to Hall, Hall theorizes that he may have founded Freemasonry.
Yes.
We know that he was a Freemason, Bacon. We don't know much about it before his era. So Hall, I don't know if he's just being like fantastical and would like that to be the truth, or whether that is the truth. It's hard to know with him. I just read his biography, by the way, Manly P. Hall.
Which crazy. One? The Man of Mysteries?
Yeah, Master of the Mysteries.
Master of Mysteries. Yeah, I didn't really like that one all that much. I feel like the guy's tone was very asshole-y.
I agree. I was going to say that. I agree. It kind of sounded like he didn't even really like Manly P.L.
Yes.
Which is a weird thing. I mean, good information, and it's kind of short. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I had read it too, because it was a fast read. Like,
I mean, yeah, he didn't really seem that great.
And do you know which rite of Freemasonry Bacon was behind? Because I know Cagliostro was the Egyptian rite, no?
Let me see.
Cagliostro.
Because I don't know.
Yeah, I think Cagliostro was the... I want to say Egyptian, right? But Bacon, because you know, there's different sects and different arms, I guess, right? Of all these secret societies, even they can't come up with like a solid ground to stand on as far as their beliefs go.
It says that he was associated with the Rosicrucians and Freemasonry. Doesn't really give a specific.
Interesting. So
here... it says that his book, The New Atlantis, which Dr. Narco Longo did an audiobook of on his channel, it says that in that Atlantis is ruled by Rosicrucians. Just funny.
Interesting. Well, that's the whole thing behind like Rosicrucianism believes in like the ascended masters, right? Very theosophical, where there's like these beings that came down from whatever planet Xenu or whatever it is, and yeah, came down. It's like they're a superior race, and I mean, you know where that goes, because it's like we've seen that in history.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, dude, if anyone's interested in Rosicrucianism, Rudolf Steiner has some, because he was a Rosicrucian earlier in his life, I'm sure later didn't really have much interest, but definitely initiated into those mysteries, and he has crazy writings on the rituals and practices of Rosicrucians. Really mystical Christian stuff, really interesting. Could be for people who maybe are a little scared of the dark arts, you know, and are, you know, want to maybe take a little more of a traditional route, using the Bible and stuff instead of some old Renaissance books. Like, for example, he says that, I think it's the first 14 lines, something like that, I have to pull it up, of the Gospel of John. He's kind of obsessed with the Gospel of John, because it's the most mystical if you read it. It's very strange. It starts off talking about the Word, like the Logos, and Steiner was all, apparently the Rosicrucians are just like, I think the Gospel of John is like where the secrets are.
Really?
Yeah, because it's kind of tacked on. And he said that it's a Rosicrucian practice to recite like at the same time every day, whether it's before bed, whether it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, doesn't matter. Same time every day. And I'd have to go read my notes. Here, I'll look it up real fast just to, I don't get this information wrong. Let's see.
Yeah, you don't.
Yeah.
We should talk to like an expert on the whole Baconian thing. I want to hit up that guy. With there's a guy with a YouTube channel that I've seen that goes like super hard in the paint as far as like the whole Rosicrucian aspect. Yo, can you still hear me? My freaking computer just like shut off.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Golly, dude. Yeah, I clean my setup. I'm like, yo, let me take out all the dust out of the computer filters and all that stuff. Treat my computer good, right? It's the life force of the podcast, essentially. That's where all the files and everything are at. And then I went ahead and I cleaned it, and I've been getting nothing but, hopefully this video looks good, because right now I'm like glitching out, bro, in the Matrix right now, the way I see myself in the video. But
I found my notes. Yeah, hopefully it turns out all right. So the Gospel of St. John is the most important gospel, according to Rudolf Steiner. He says it has the full power and light of God manifest in it, and that secret societies of the Middle Ages all studied it, so Templars, Cathars, Rosicrucians, you name it, as being very, very important. Steiner believes it holds knowledge of a future version of Christianity that will spread. Bible scholars believe it was from the second century and therefore could have been considered mystical poetry or Alexandrian philosophy, almost like Neoplatonism. So the Rosicrucians, according to Steiner, would meditate on the first 14 lines of the Gospel of John every day, and they believed that those lines had magical power. If you repeated them at the same time, day after day, you would begin to relive the Gospels and their events in your dreams. So you would go through like the stations, the cross, like the whole deal in your own dreams. And he says they would see Jesus being born and all the way up until his resurrection in your dreams. And I can read the first 14 lines if you want.
And it's interesting because, right, who John is, and then what these Knights Templar allegedly had, which was the head of, right, John the Baptist,
right,
which was perhaps prophesied.
Yeah, Well, so yeah, it could be. Yeah, but Steiner even makes the case that John in the Bible is not mentioned until after Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And so Rudolf Steiner says that John is actually Lazarus initiated. So Lazarus died, Jesus brings him back, and now he's John, and John's delivering the goods from the other
John
side.
John is JC's homunculi, bro. I said it. That's some necromantical shit
saying,
right there.
This is good stuff.
That's Steiner. What Steiner is that? Like, where can people find that if they wanted to?
That's from a book called Esoteric Cosmology by Rudolf Steiner. It's like a 150-page book. It's really short. And it's a good overview. It gives a lot. It's different chapters on cosmology, as you would imagine, but also Christian mysticism, Rosicrucianism, heaven, astral world, chakras, you name it.
Yeah.
It's in there. He goes over like different forms of initiation, like I just talked about Lazarus dying, coming back, and then John appears in the Bible, and Steiner, and apparently these other secret societies believe that John was the initiated Lazarus.
That's crazy.
And that's why the Gospel of John has the secret, has got the goods, because he's one of them. He's initiated.
Well, and this makes, right, the Manichaeans, the Cathars, the Bogomils, all these people that worshipped John the Baptist, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Wow, that's wild, dude. And the idea of what baptism represents. Yeah. Like you're being born again.
Sure. And I think we talked about that baptism, possibly according to Rupert Sheldrake, not a signified, but literally was a near-death experience. So it was a drowning.
Mm-hmm.
That's trippy. But yeah, like you're saying, worshiping John, you know, they saw him as an initiate, like a follower of Jesus who died, came back, was led through that by Jesus himself, and learned the mysteries. And initiates in ancient times would be put into a coffin. You know, they would do this sort of, and they, you know, kind of do that with like Skull and Bones and things like that. But they
the
would
Knights
put you
Templar in, allegedly too had a ritual where they would die for 3 days, right?
Sure. And they would so initiates in ancient times would be put into a coffin for days, and their soul would leave the body and go to the astral worlds and see all kinds of crazy mystical stuff. And people, Steiner even says that it's possible that there was like a magi or some sort of person who was like molding you, like your astral body while you were out of it, almost like massaging, like turning you into, you know, like a initiate, perfecting you while you were away, which is really trippy. But then you would come back and the person would be initiated. You would have left the body, sort of realized your immortality or whatever, have you seen all this crazy stuff, and then come back. An interesting thing to tie that into one of our later subjects is that, you know, they always say that there's been no mummies found in the pyramids. But
bro,
in the king's chamber, what is there? There's a massive coffin.
Box, yeah.
Box with nothing in it. No dead people. Why? Because people were being initiated in the Great Pyramid. So the initiates would be put in there in like this energy harnessing massive pyramid full of quartz and ascend, basically. They would just go off into space and come back. And that's why there's no actual mummies, because these people weren't actually dying there. They weren't actually being literally buried there. They were symbolically dying there, symbolically being buried there. And this is, we'll get into our next thing. Who, you know, how many people have had those experiences in the pyramids? You have Alexander the Great went to the pyramids.
Crowley.
He had he had crazy stuff happen. You have Crowley, who went to the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, and had the Book of the Law delivered. And you have Napoleon.
Hold on, bro. Before we go there, read the first. Wait, you said 15 lines. You said,
yeah, I'll read them for you. So John, chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning the light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and through the world was made through him. The world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. That's it.
I wonder what that reads like in the original.
That's a good question.
You know,
and it is tricky, even in its current form, is like,
yeah,
you know, the one, the Word is, you know, man, and you're just like, what? Like,
very Platonic.
It is very Neoplatonic, which, it, like I said, they say that it came from second century Alexandria, which is where the Neoplatonists, where it was going down, and Kabbalah was forming at the same time in the same place.
So, because one of the things that's always interested me was like with the John of Revelation and mm-hmm. like how that was John. And by the way, Juan is another version of John. So I guess you could, right? So we're talking about John, so John on John podcast. Doesn't sound as good, but yeah, that's also, people have sometimes called me John throughout my life. But right, you have the whole idea of the book of Revelation, even though it was a different John. But now that you're saying this idea of like, oh, the initiated versus the uninitiate, it's like, wow, there's kind of something there too. It's like, what if this dude, this other John, was, it could have potentially been the same people in some way, shape, or form, right? Let's think outside the box. Let's throw the traditional timeline out of the, because that's like, That's one of the things about the Bible, where it's like, oh, let's disregard all this crazy mystic raising people from the dead and all that stuff. It's like, oh, but you got to stick to this timeline, bro. This person was,
yeah.
Come on, you know what I'm saying?
And by the way, Lazarus, just to put a little support on what I said earlier, the only gospel that mentions the miracle of raising Lazarus is the Gospel of John. And I think it's the last thing that happens in that gospel too.
Wait, what? Say that again?
So the raising of Lazarus from the dead happens in the Gospel of John. That's where it's found in the Bible. And it's not found elsewhere.
Interesting. So there's something very alchemical and very cryptic to that. Huh.
Yeah. And apparently, according to Steiner, all the secret societies, especially the Christian influenced ones, so the Cathars, the Rosicrucians, and what have you, were onto this like it was nobody's business. They were all into Gospel of John.
And I don't know a lot about Lazarus, but
mm-hmm.
hold on. Oh man, this is crazy, because I just Googled, I'm trying to pull up the plates of where you take the bones of the king and you put it in the sarcophagus or the coffin, and then the king writes in pieces, and then the king comes back. And I Googled the resurrecting king plate, and look at what came up. Lazarus of Bethany.
Oh, damn. That's crazy.
Because, again, and I'm not because some people will be like, oh, well, there's actually writings about how people would alchemize, like, quite literally everything, like any ancient text. So it got to the point where during, like, the Renaissance time, they were taking all allegorical and metaphorical stories and be like, oh, that's alchemy. Oh, and that's alchemy too. And it's like, no, sometimes they're just stories and they're not alchemical in nature. But you just unlock, like, this whole thing in me where I'm like, wait a minute, now, you know, it makes a lot more sense from the alchemical perspective of these plates showing certain things. And here it is in like a LARPing type of way where they're quite literally telling these stories, right? Like they're acting them out in, like, this book, which is the Bible, right? So, like, you take the alchemical allegories and you turn it into a story, and you hide those alchemical secrets within this story, if that makes any sense.
Sure. And, you know, in the initiatory rituals of Freemasonry, for each degree, like you were just saying, acting these things out as, like, drama, you watch a play. So in each degree of Freemasonry, you basically are watching a symbolic play.
What?
Acted out by the brothers in
Shakespeare.
Front of you. Yeah, right. And then obviously you could tie in like Shakespeare and all that if you want. But, you know, that is, they are initiatory. And there is drama. And there is myth. Obviously, that all that just is myth. And myth is not like how we think of it today, where it's like, oh, that's a myth. You know, it's far more deeper than we could even imagine.
What the bro? So, and I think I can find in the 12 Keys of Valentine. Let me see if he has the king where they bury him. You know what I'm talking about, where they bury the bones of the king and then he comes back out of the tomb in one piece. Let me see here. I want to find it now. The 12 Keys of Basil Valentine. Here we go. Let's see. All right. So you have this very just weird stuff, man. Like, that's what I love about alchemy. It's so trippy, dude. So weird. And it's like such a large part of history. Right. So you have, again, this is not the one I'm looking for, but they in some depictions, they resurrect. And I think it's in Atlantifugians 2 by Mayer.
It's found on Masonic ritual. It says, Masonic ritual is a full body experience, offering total sensual immersion. The initiations are not unlike visiting a modern day IMAX theater. However, the latter experience is synthetical, whereas Masonic immersion is organic. Dramatists of the ancient world understood this principle, that theater was not about entertainment, but initiation, religion, catharsis, and psychological development. The creators of Masonic ceremonies also understood this, and they succeeded in converting the theater into a Masonic temple.
Let's go. The cinemagicians, hard at work.
Absolutely. And you watch things unfold in front of you, basically.
This was the OG alchemical hot box. I'm going to show you right now. Hold up. So that's Atlanta Fugians right here. This dude's hot boxing, bro.
Damn,
dude. Sauna. This was the OG theater right there. So, and these plates you have, and this is a really interesting one too, because with these plates, there was music that you could also play with. Right, look, Jung used this emblem too, this plate. But you're just like helping me connect all these dots in my mind right now, as far as like this whole initiation and how, right? You have magical names. Here it is, right here. So the Typhon kills Osiris. Osiris, right? That's an S. Not by the C, and. Yeah. Disperses his limbs, but famous. God, I hate these things. I don't know what that is right there, but gathered them together.
Man, that's trippy. Yeah, the initiatory burial. I could read you the stages of initiation rituals that are found throughout, like Christian secret societies.
According to Stein. I think here there's one of them where they take his body apart. Right here in the background, his body's taken apart, and you can't really see him on these because they're not that well. But right, he's the king, and just what a weird thing. Like what a weird, Like what? How do you even, like, bro? I go up to you and I go, hey, dude, you're an artist. Draw me getting this.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Make me. How do you even begin to he's going to be a king in a coffin, and then in the back he's going to be dismembered, and then there's going to be somebody picking that up, and then there's going to be some people, you know, like in the back behind there, and they're going to be doing like what in
the world? That is great. Well, Plotinus says in the Enneads that if you were to be tortured, like if you were to be torn apart like that, it sounds like they're sort of symbolically representing what he's saying. He said, if you were being tortured, and your body was just being torn apart in some sort of medieval torture device, that, and you know, he's pretty hardcore philosopher. He's like, that shouldn't matter at all because your body's just a shadow of your soul. You know, it's just like an image, a symbol of what your real soul is. So it's not easy to say, but it's possible that they are representing something like that idea.
Yeah. Okay. Like you go ahead and take that then, bro.
So here, I'll give you some of the stages that you have dreams of in this Steinerian Gospel of John initiation. So the first one is you'll be washing somebody's feet in your dreams. And these all have esoteric meanings. So they're not just things that happened that Jesus did. They're things that you reenact in your dreams, sort of incited by this the first 14 verses or lines. And you'll be washing someone's feet. And so this is like an esoteric law that you're learning. And it's that it's not just humility, like most people think. It's the esoteric law that higher things can only exist because of lower things. So it's like a consubstantiality, meaning there's both things are dependent on each other to exist at all. And so Jesus can't exist without his disciples and without us, like without mankind. And then we can't exist without him, kind of thing. And so we're all sort of codependent. And that is washing the feet. It's like an esoteric initiation. And then you move on to the scourging, which is when you're basically being tortured. You're being whipped and things like that. And that's, you know, becoming fearless and courageous and heroic. And you have a vision of that happening to you, which gives you a wider sense of love and feeling of living within the body, sort of thing. Then you go on to a dream where you have the famous crown of thorns placed on you. And that represents like a rational stoicism, meaning not just stoicism like by brute force, but rational stoicism. So you're able to break things down logically and say, okay, well, this isn't a big deal because of X, Y, and Z, you know, be gone kind of thing. It's like a mental stoicism. Disassociation, saying yes to life and being moral. And then a very serious event occurs during the stage, which involves the appearance of the guardian of the threshold, which is an astral double of yourself, much like a holy guardian angel in like Crowley's type system or something like that, which appears in physical form before you. So you got the crown of thorns on. This thing, this doppelganger,
the dweller of the abyss.
Yeah, which Jung, in the Red Book, he calls it his other eye. And it's like it's a shadow, appears to you in your dream in physical form, and it's like disgusting. It's like the most like it's like a zombie, like hideous
very
creature.
Very Lovecraftian.
Yeah. And you have to master it in order to avoid insanity. Then you move on to the bearing of the cross, which is a feeling of oneness and association with the whole earth and everything on it. So it's like the ultimate burden of the world. You're literally Atlas in Greek mythology, right? Bearing the world. Then your next dream, these are all initiatory dreams that you have basically in these secret societies, is a mystic death. So the initiate is bearing all the suffering of the world, like Atlas, like Christ, and becomes aware of death. And they move closer to death, and eventually an inner light comes into awareness. And Steiner compares that light to sound. So he says that this like inner light, this like reignition of your soul that happens through that initiation is similar to when you plug your ears. And it's not like when you plug your ears, you can't hear anything. You just hear stuff that's happening inside, you know? You hear your heart beating, you hear like your stomach moving, and you hear, may hear it ringing or something. And he says it's the same thing with like your consciousness, that when you shut off the, you know, you're bearing the entire world, and you sort of shut off the outer world and you move inwards, but it's not like nothing happened. The opposite happens. So it comes from within now. The world sort of ignites in front of you on the interior, the sort of astral world. Let's see, like, and he kind of, Steiner at least, compared that to numbers too, which is like a Pythagorean thing, that when you're approaching zero, you think that the number line's going to be over, but then it just goes into negative numbers and keeps going. Yeah, that kind of thing. So your next initiation, your next dream is your entombment, where you're freed from the body and you're among the stars. You're just like flying astrally. And you're literally, you identify as the earth. So you are the earth. And then the planets are like your contemporaries. They're like your buddies. And so then you really start to take on like that astrological, alchemical, like planetary influence becomes real.
Unus mundus. Like,
right. You're the earth and they're like right next to you kind of thing. And then the last, obviously the last initiation dream in these societies is the resurrection. So Steiner says that that's almost impossible to describe in language, but that the initiate emerges with the power of healing and things like that. You know, obviously like an awareness of immortality and so on. Yeah, it's trippy stuff. I mean,
whoa, dude. And that's Rosicrucianism, right? That's mystical Christian.
That's Christian mysticism.
Mysticism. Yep.
Wow. The three Rosicrucians, Cathars, Templars, they were all practicing that kind of dream initiation, astral initiation, I guess you could call it. But they would set you up basically ritually to have these dreams, experience these things, and through the stages of Jesus's life, you would learn like these esoteric principles and laws and actually live them out as experience and not just dogma. So that's what makes it mystical.
And this was activated through this reading of the first, what did we say, 14 lines?
Yeah, Gospel of John.
So that's how you knew you were doing it right, because you would do this every day, same time, same thing, over and over again, and then you'd go to sleep that night. And then if you had one of these dreams, you knew you were on the right path or the right track.
Yeah. You'd start off with the first one, or apparently you would see Jesus being born in a dream, and then you would sort of identify as Jesus from then on.
Whoa.
And live out those things in successive dreams. And that was your initiation, like full on, like you learned everything you had to learn. There was not a whole lot else you needed to be taught. You know, you lived it. In whatever that was, maybe like 10 dreams or something. I don't know. I wasn't counting, but something like
probably that. 12 dreams.
Yeah, right. Probably. Yeah. Probably 12 dreams or 7 dreams or something.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild stuff. And like I was saying earlier, in the pyramids, they were doing these sort of initiations in coffins, you know, entombing you, letting the mind just detach and fly around. And
so
all these historical characters that clearly had experiences in the pyramids like that.
Look, these guys look like they're having a great time. And this is from Manly P. Hall. It's from I want to say it's either, it's one of the three journals, the Horizon or the other ones, not the All-Seeing Eye. I don't think it's the All-Seeing Eye. Anyways, whatever. But it's called The Initiation in the King's Chamber. It's what you were talking about, how maybe perhaps this place was used as a sort of metaphysical, I think it was like a metaphysical, a canon for like your soul. So you would get loaded up in there. And the reason I say that is because I did an episode 177 where my buddy Luke, he's just sitting down and telling us about all these different trips that he's taken, and one trip in particular that he just recently took earlier this year, where he was in the King's Chamber at 2 a.m. and they were just hanging out in there, right, looking around, and they started chanting, and they would get in the box, and the box vibrates, right? Because you're not allowed to hum any tones, do anything while you're in there if you have, like, a strict tour guide. But the tour guides that he goes with are just, like, you know, friends of his. So they let him do... 100 years ago,
Crowley rented it out. So times have changed. You know?
Yes.
They didn't even care back then.
Literally. Yeah, exactly. So, and that's one of the things that I talked to him about. I'm like, you know, Crowley was... essentially prophesized to on in the King's Chamber. So what you were saying, that these people throughout history, some of the more significant people throughout history, right, might maybe could have gone through a sort of initiation. Yeah. And then Napoleon Bonaparte being one of the ones that had also, I didn't even know that he went there.
Oh yeah, yeah. Pull that up. So obviously, Napoleon took Egypt. So he's a wild man. He went down and he's like, all right, I'm just gonna take Egypt. I'm gonna bring all my scholars, like translate a bunch of stuff, get everything. It was under Turkish control, and so he said, let's get the Turks out. And in the process, it's gonna create a problem for England. It was like his enemy, because maybe they needed the Nile or something to get to some other colonies that they had. But he was like, yeah, this is going to screw England. I'm going to be in the middle. And it's just cool to have Egypt, because obviously Alexander the Great took Egypt too. He's a hero of his. And in the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, you could look it up. He had a mystical experience where he has a famous quote about it, something like, I can't put it into words or something like that. And he doesn't describe it, which is terrible. I wish he did. But he does not describe his experience in the Great Pyramid that I know of. But he does say that something happened that was, like, profound. And, yeah, that's fascinating. And then, you know, he, in his whole life, had all kinds of, he had ghost stories. He believed that he was like the culmination of legends and prophecies that told of like him coming to sort of rule the world or rule Europe. He had ghost stories and all kinds of paranormal type things as well that are super interesting.
So this quote here, it doesn't, it's not a quote. I'm trying to find the quote that, where he talked about the little red man. So the red man stops the last efforts of the tyrant, death offering the only means of escape from his exile. And so allegedly, right, what we wanted to get into after all this time at the very beginning was the myth of Napoleon and the red man. And it's interesting because I'm not sure. Does Jung describe the devil when he meets him, Satan? Does he describe what he looks like? Does he call him the red man?
The red rider, yeah.
The red rider.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
he's like a ginger, like Viking, like massive ginger guy who like gleams red, yeah.
The red man appeared for the first time to General Bonaparte, then in Egypt, the evening before the Battle of the Pyramids. Napoleon, attended by several officers, was riding past one of those monuments of antiquity when a man wrapped in a red mantle came out of the pyramid and motioned him to alight and follow him. Bonaparte complied, and then they went together in the interior of the pyramid.
Oh my God.
After an hour had elapsed, the officers became uneasy at the long absence of their commander. They were just on the point of entering the monument in quest of him when he came forth with a look of evident satisfaction. Before this interview with the red man, he had steadfastly refused to give battle, but now he issued orders to prepare immediately for attack, and the following day he gained the victory of the pyramids. So, this little red man that supposedly Bonaparte had encountered,
mm-hmm.
right? Napoleon Bonaparte was born in Corsica, an island, et cetera, et cetera. The 19th century guidebook observed the Corsicans believe in the Malocchio, or evil eye, and in witchcraft as sturdily as their ancestors of the 16th century. While Napoleon did not believe in witchcraft, he was prone to more everyday superstitions and has been credited with some fantastical beliefs. So Josephine, right, brought him good luck. He became accustomed to associate the idea of her influence with every piece of good furniture. It's almost like a feng shui type of thing going on here. Napoleon's sure. lucky star. We have mm-hmm. relates to Monsieur Passy, who claimed to have heard it directly from General upon the siege, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see it up there? That is my star. There it is, shining before you. It has never left me. I see it in all great moments. I wonder if he's talking about, like, the North Star.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. He thinks it's his.
Yeah. It's like, when you wish upon a star, right? Like, that whole thing. I see nothing. In exile, Napoleon referred to his lucky star in a conversation. Omens. Regarded some incidents as omens. Carried a miniature portrait of Josephine. When the glass on the portrait accidentally broke, Napoleon turned pale with dread and said, "Either my wife is very ill or she is unfaithful." Yikes. So, numbers and dates. Napoleon disliked Fridays and the number 13. He would never begin a journey on a Friday or the 13th of a month. On the other hand, he regarded some dates particularly auspicious. After winning the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805, he considered December 2nd one of his lucky dates, especially since his coronation had occurred. So this guy was like going hard in the paint. This guy was going to take over the world, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So the red man.
This is crazy.
Zotzen said that Napoleon periodically saw a phantom called the red man. Here's a summary of what the tales reported in February 1815 before Napoleon made his escape from Elba. The gentleman from... All right, so...
Looks long. But I know a lot of it just off the top of my head.
So at the pyramid wasn't the first time that he had...
No. No, so this is even more interesting. Not only were the pyramids not the first time that he saw the red man, but he wasn't even the first person to see the red man. So there was French royalty... Who had encounters with this red man, this little homunculus like gnome. They described him as like a gnome in all red kind of thing, who would come to them and just be like giving them prophecies, like making deals with them, all kinds of typical, you know, sprightly things. And I forgot the lady's name, Catherine or something like that, some French aristocrat, royal. Had encounters with him too and ended up dying. And I think her husband died and he prophesied a bunch of like horrible things before the revolution. And then the red man started reporting to Napoleon, appearing to him like out of nowhere. He would just like pop up and he made deals with Napoleon. He said like, you're going to have 10 years of victory, 10 years of success. And then Napoleon's like, can I get another 5? You know, like when the 10 is up.
Let me read this. So the following singular story was circulated almost immediately after the fall of Napoleon, and with credulous obtained ready belief. The gentleman from whom this curious communication was received heard it related with the following particulars on the first day of January at Paris, where he spent the whole of the winter. The 1st of January, 1814, early in the morning, Napoleon shut himself up in his cabinet. Let me zoom into this. In his cabinet, bidding Count Moly, then counselor of state, to remain in the next room and to hinder any person whatever from troubling him while he was occupied in his cabinet. He had not long retired to his study when a tall man dressed in red applied to Mole, pretending that he wanted to speak to the emperor. He was answered that it was not possible. I must speak to him. Go and tell him that it is the red man who wants him, and he will admit me. Awed by the imperious and commanding tone of the strange personage, Moly obeyed reluctantly and trembling, executed his dangerous errand. Let him in, said Bonaparte sternly. Prompted by curiosity, Moly listened at the door and overheard the following curious conversation. So, if we're to believe this mole guy, and he wasn't alone in this apparition, if you will, this thing, yeah, right? But here he's tall, so I don't know. Maybe he's a big homunculus. Like, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, no, so he could be like appearing differently to different people.
True. So the red man said, "This is my third appearance before you. The first time we met was in Egypt at the Battle of the Pyramids." So that one thing where he had disappeared for a little bit. "The second after the Battle of Wagram. I then granted you 4 years more to terminate the conquest of Europe or to make a general peace, threatening you that if you did not perform one of these two things, I would withdraw my protection from you. Now I am come for the third and last time to warn you that you have now but 3 months to complete the execution of your designs or to comply with the proposals of peace offered you by the Allies. If you do not achieve the one or accede to the other, all will be over with you. So remember it well." Napoleon then expostulated with him to obtain more time on the plea that it was impossible in so short a space to reconquer what he had lost or to make peace on honorable terms. "Do as you please," said the red man, "but my resolution is not to be shaken by entreaties nor otherwise, and I go." He opened the door. The emperor followed, entreating him, but to no purpose. The red man would not stop any longer. He went away, casting on his imperial majesty a contemptuous look and repeating in a stern voice, 3 months, no longer." Napoleon made no reply, but his fiery eyes darted fury, and he returned sullenly into his cabinet, which he did not leave the whole day. Such were the reports that were spread in Paris 3 months before the fall of Napoleon Bonaparte, where they caused an unusual sensation and created a superstitious belief among the people that he had dealings with infernal spirits and was bound to fulfill their will or perish. Who the red man really was has never been known, but that such a person obtained an interview with him seems to be placed beyond a doubt. Even the French papers, when Bonaparte was deposed, recurred to the fact and remarked that his mysterious visitant's prophetic threat had been accomplished. What the heck, bro?
Yeah, that is not in your high school history book.
So other versions of the legend say the red man advised Napoleon against the invading of Russia and appeared to him in his coronation and on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo. However, the stories say more about French
folk. Oh, yeah. Down in the next paragraph, you'll see what I was talking about. That the same little red gnome thing.
Medici?
Yeah, Medici's other people. Like, it was not just Napoleon. Napoleon was probably the most notable, obviously, because he's Napoleon.
Bro, I know who the red man was.
Yeah. And if you look up...
This was the red man.
No, forget the Mothman. Look up... All right, this is way better. Look up the Nain Rouge. So N-A-I-N space N-A-I-N.
I-N.
Rouge. R-O-U-G-E. What R-O-U-G-E. Yeah, that one. So the Nain Rouge is literally a red like gnome devil in Michigan folklore.
What?
Yes. And it's like the same little
type
thing.
Of hobo goblin.
Hobgoblin, yeah.
Or hop, yeah. My bad. I'm retarded.
English offspring.
There's such thing as a hobo goblin though, right?
Probably. I've seen a few.
Hold on, I have to Oh no, it's hobgoblin. Oh my god, I've been reading this wrong my entire life. Oh man. All right. Representation of Nine Rouge used to promote Detroit beer company, the Detroit Dwarf. Interesting.
And Detroit, it's French.
Ooh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is wild. See?
And was
see
that-
also Mothman. So we're talking about...
All right, here, this ties it all together. So you have the Nain Rouge, which is part of Michigan folklore. Like, someone in Detroit knows exactly what that is. Just like someone in New Jersey knows exactly what the Mothman is. The Nain Rouge is in Michigan. Michigan was part of the Louisiana Purchase, where America bought that land from France. Who was the ruler of France when we bought Louisiana?
No.
Napoleon.
No.
As we bought Michigan from Napoleon, and they literally have this little red gnome demon running around Detroit.
Bro.
Just saying.
That's wild.
Hobgoblin escaped to Michigan.
Well, it kind of ties in with like the whole Bock Tower thing, where like the little gnomes were seen, you know, shortly after the tower had been built, kind of sort of like in the area. Like, right. That's such a bizarre yeah. thing.
And then Detroit was the center of the world, you know, up until the 60s, you know, for 30, 40 years with the automotive industry. And Crowley went to Detroit. There's a book about Crowley in Detroit, yes. By, I think, Kaczynski, Richard Kaczynski, his biographer. There's all kinds of trippy ties. But yeah, the Louisiana Purchase was from Napoleon. And we bought all that territory from him because he needed to fund those wars. That's why it was so cheap.
Whoa, dude. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a crazy connection. So, what do you think it was? What do you speculate this little red man was? Like, do you think it was like a it reminds me of like the unknown speaker, the shadow man during the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Right. Yeah, Manly P. Hall talks about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's tricky too. Yeah, to me it is like a sort of haunting archetypal figure that haunts the collective unconscious, and when it needs to make itself known, it makes itself known.
Do you think that's his hat on the French, the coat of arms?
Could be.
See, it's got like a little freaking red hat.
Yeah.
That's so. See, you got the little red hat here and the one here, and the all like an eye. That's like an eye right there. Wow, bro. Dropping the hammer with the what can we dub this? The Napoleon homunculi. Napoleon. Is there like another word for Napoleon that we can use? I'm like Napoleon. The Bonaparte homunculus.
This is crazy, dude. Reading about the Nain Rouge. It's been seen in Michigan since the 1700s.
So before the Louisiana Purchase, then?
Before, yeah.
Yeah. So what if...
Crazier. That's not like... I thought it was like modern folklore. This is going on at like the same time.
So what if, again, it was like some... So they call it the demon of the strait. Like what if something happens... What if it attaches itself to him or them? But why would it visit other people before? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd never heard of this before, dude. I'd never heard of, I know you had texted me about it, but I didn't look any more into it. And you brought it full circle.
It's crazy. I try my best.
So, dude, you want to add anything else before we get out of here? This is great. We got a lot of stuff we talked about. Car. We were all over the place. We talked about Descartes, Neoplatonism, Devil Automatons. We got alchemy. We got Infant Jesus of Prague. We got some Jung in there. We got the Red Book. Yeah, dude. Want to add anything else? Want to leave the people with something before we go?
No. I can't think. I mean, anything too interesting that's like...
It's all good, bro. I'm going to be doing an episode on the... on that gate. So if you want to join me on that, it's going to be with homie Romy.
Yeah, I'm in. I'm in for anything. Just let me know. I'll be there.
Because that's a deep dive, bro. I'll send you the name after, but...
I'm going to be in Kissimmee on Sunday.
Let me know. I got something else.
I probably won't be able to stop and see you. Just saying. I'll be in... Is he a gem show?
Whack.
At Osceola, whatever you call it. Osceola Park or something. There's a huge like wholesale gem show that we go to.
Well, if I go, can you get me in with you as like a vendor with you?
Yeah.
All right. I'll let you know then. See what time. I have something on Sunday, but we'll talk about it. But
all right.
As always, everyone, make sure to once Longo's book is out, I'm sure, I don't know if he's going to want to plug it or not, but if he does, I'll post the link if it's out by the time this is out, whenever. But make sure to follow the show, tjojp.com, at the Juan on Juan podcast on all social media platforms. If you're on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, wherever you are, comment, like, subscribe, leave a 5-star review. And as always, Professor Longo came, he saw, he conquered, he dropped the homunculus hammer on us and some esoteric initiatory knowledge.
So, yeah.
All right, brother. Thank you again. And as always, everyone, see you on the other side.